Welcome to the Aesthetic City podcast. In this show, we aim to discover how to go forward and create a more livable, beautiful, and healthy built environment. I'm Ruben Hansen, your host and founder of the Aesthetic City. Today's guest is a master craftsman and plasterer. Our guest is former professor of plaster working at the American College of the Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina. Through years of experience with his firm, Real Finishes, he has built up a wealth of knowledge on craft as a profession and about architecture in general. His well-developed views on society, beauty, and many other topics make him more of a philosopher plasterer. So please welcome Patrick Webb. Thank you so much, Patrick, for joining us.
Of course.
Thank you, yeah. So we just met in Belgium at the Belem Castle near Bruges for the La Table Ronde summer school, where you were training a group of summer school students at the La Table Ronde summer school in the crafts. How was that experience like? How was that?
Well, I was very thankful to be invited. Two things really stood out to me. I think, number one, that the school that they've established there is so dedicated to integrating the crafts in with the study of architecture. In fact, Nadia, who's the principal one organizing the school, said that if she can't have a school that integrates craft in the study of architecture, she'd rather not have a school at all. And that to me says a lot. The second point that really impressed me was that the school is really drawing from the local environment where it's being taught. So It's studying Gothic architecture. And to my knowledge, it's the only school of its kind. I received some training in Gothic architecture because of my stone carving apprenticeship, which was in after the manner of the English cathedral system. But that was strictly from a craft perspective. So to see both the craft aspects and then architecture being taught, referencing Gothic architecture is amazing. They're doing magical things there.
Yeah. It's the beauty of traditional architecture education because it is extremely rare. And then on top of that, you have this school that goes into this lost art in a beautiful environment. I think it's a shame that there is only a couple of summer schools right now in Europe, at least, who choose to teach this, because there's I think a lot of people who would love to learn how to do this.
I would say at least there's a few schools now teaching this as summer schools, because if you go back just 10 years ago, there was nothing. And so there's a lot of energy and momentum, and I just absorbed it all in. Even visiting, you all having visited us from the school that was also ongoing in Utrecht in the Netherlands, and seeing the excitement of those students and some of their presentations, know, it's something very special. It's a unique time.
Yeah. Does it give you some hope for the landscape of traditional architecture and what is happening now?
No. What I mean by that is in the short term to medium term, I think the prospects for making effective change on a national, continental, global scale, those prospects are very dim. However, I think the long-term prospects end up being very, very positive. And there's always the case, though, to be made that for the people that are involved, it makes all the difference in the world. So the lives that it touches, it makes a lot of difference.
Yeah. Although I do see like new networks growing and more people getting activated in the space through the summer school who start to do their thing and kind of this growing network effect, although it's still a small bubble, of course. So, yeah. But so on the medium term, what do you think that should happen in order to get some real material change to happen?
I don't put too much emphasis on the things that I can't control, the results, let's say. But I think of us more as having entered something like akin to a dark ages, We don't necessarily feel that we're in a dark ages because we have iPhones and air conditioning, but this has been some of the greatest loss of collective human knowledge, understanding of the world, different ways of living in the world that's occurred in human history. And why movements like this are so important, that we have almost a monastic function. As so much knowledge is being lost, we are trying to, you know, grab those manuscripts, those figurative, metaphorical manuscripts, and grab and copy them one more time and pass them on to a subsequent generation. Because the type of knowledge we're losing is at the worst possible time. It's how to live not only sustainably, but generatively on this planet, when it's being taxed and stressed so much ecologically. So we're doing important work, I think, rather than hoping to inspire great change. I'm more of a kind of a preservation mindset, preservation of knowledge.
Yeah, so do you believe this dark age is not only in architecture, it's probably more, you could maybe a spiritual dark age as well? Do you think that as well?
Oh, sure. I think we entered that dark age some time ago because architecture lags behind. It's a material representation, you could say, of the way a society already thinks. So we have a certain view of the world, and then we shape the world around us according to that viewpoint.
Yeah. Is there any hope of changing that that way of thinking? I mean, if I could only imagine the answer is probably not, because it's just such a strong, overwhelming force, and it's so massive. So many people who think this way or don't have this vision of the world anymore. But then you would maybe need to create a new belief system, which is very radical in how it spreads to counter it, perhaps. I don't know what your thoughts on this are.
Well, I mean, you and I are very small, even our movement's very small, and the world is very big. And so I think sometimes things just have to kind of run their course. I think it's rather unfortunate, but, you know, the way we think about the world in terms, look at the world very mechanically, very instrumentally, the extraction of resources, I think those type of things just have to run their course. They have to collapse in a way. So we've been kind of on a frenzy, a feeding frenzy of the Earth's resources, taking things like, I mean, obviously petroleum and nuclear fuels, creating things like concrete. These things are not inherently bad in themselves. I mean, I think they had the possibility to serve humanity's best interest for millions of years. They're actually quite precious things, and it's our squandering of those resources in just a few generations that's what's wrong about them. What we live on is essentially, you know, a big dirty rock covered with a little bit of flora. And getting back to a little bit towards architecture, you know, that's how we've always built. Primary, I guess, material resource that we've always used is what's unlimited: earth, earthen construction, things like adobe and rammed earth, and rock, of course, stone. Stone only, the only resources it consumes is just whatever you need to feed a human being, however many calories a day, so that they can work it. I mean, nothing at all. It's the cheapest material imaginable. And so building of earth, building of stone, you know, using the resources of things like grasses and for fuel and for construction, limited amount of wood in a responsible way. It's just unlimited. I mean, this is our home. And these are our natural world that surrounds us. And that's a way of kind of living in accord with nature.
Yeah, one theme I might want to pick up on later is the question of what role has modernism in this story, and will it extinguish itself because it is not sustainable, or maybe it is, I don't know. I don't think so, but maybe that's, I can park it for later. Perhaps, maybe before we go more into the philosophical topics, I would first, as a little introduction, go back to your background. So how did you get into the crafts and into plaster and, well, the crafts in general?
Child slavery. I say that a little tongue in cheek. You know, my father and my uncle, some of my first memories are working with them. And yeah. So my father comes from both my father and my uncle came from an agricultural background in Jamaica, where we're from, and moved to England, where, you know, not much agricultural opportunity there. They got into the crafts, but already used to working with his hands, as most people living on farms do. And so he basically became what you would call in England a decorator, which means someone that works with wall coverings, be they plaster, sometimes painting and wall coverings, wallpaper. And I learned those things from a very, very young age with him. Then probably when I was about 9-10 years old, he began to build houses. And so then I got to learn a variety of trades, framing, yeah. finished carpentry, foundations, roofing. And he always had a kind of a traditional idea of design, formed probably mostly by English precedent, Tudor design, I'd say. And so that was at least my foundation in the arts and crafts. And from there, I went to specialize for the most part in plaster work.
Yeah. But was it kind of a standard path, or was it in your time already a special thing to do?
Oh, yeah. I think plaster work, because we were in the States, at least during the school year, I spent my time and was educated here in the United States. And it was, you know, like they like to say, a dying craft. It was just, you know, some older, typically Italian or Irish fellows in their 70s still practicing it at the higher levels, I would say, you know, things like moldings, ornament, and that type of specialty work. So it was very rare that anyone like myself, very young, would be entering the craft. The industrial modern means of construction had taken over by that point. So, you know, drywall had completely supplanted plaster as a wall surface, and then very little in wood, just, you know, production, cheap poplars and pine woods were being used for moldings, if moldings were being used at all, which they were kind of disappearing as a architectural element.
And has that changed since, or?
Slightly. So I would say that for the most part in commercial, institutional new construction, very, very little is done in any way that even resembles anything traditional. Where traditional architecture, you could say, has kind of survived, at least I'm speaking of the United States, North America more generally, has been high-end residential, because people with means, people who are well-traveled, they can insist on having something at least close to what they want. And what they overwhelmingly want is something traditional. So for plaster work, it has created much more opportunity. I basically have seen since my maturity in the late 80s, early 90s, until now, there's only been an increased demand for plaster work and new construction in the high-end luxury residential market. And there's plenty of restoration work available too. Much more demand than there is people to do the work. But there's not the interest from young people to enter the crafts at all. And there are reasons for that. You know, that you know, we could get into if you like. But so I'm personally just constantly overwhelmed by work, and I'm one of the youngest, I would say, you know, plasterers around, and I'm not that young. Wow. I'm in my mid-50s.
So. Yeah. So less young people are interested now into going into the crafts, and there are some reasons for that. So is it income? Is it, what are the biggest reasons?
It's definitely not income. I would say that hand craftsmanship in the US pays very well. It's quite lucrative. It's unfortunately, it's no, I don't think it's necessarily that either. I've had a number of apprentices, lost many, and it always seems to boil down to one reason. It's considered low status. And the entire educational system in the United States is geared towards university education and essentially white collar work. So I always say you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a master craftsman. It's more difficult than that. It doesn't require just your mind. It also requires your body, actually your whole being. And so, but it's considered low status. So particularly with young men entering the crafts, a lot of times they wash out because quite frankly, they have if they want to get married, have a family, they have great difficulty. What they do is looked at as just labor. Yeah. It's just, you know, you wouldn't want to be married to somebody like that or in a relationship with someone like that.
Yeah.
And it's a real problem. It's the same problem that the farming community is having. Our farm community in the United States is now getting very old. And they typically they do quite well financially, but as far as status, nobody wants to be, you know, be with a farmer. They want to have that city life.
Yeah, that's really a shame. Yeah,
I mean, eating's not important after all, you know.
I mean,
it's not an important human activity.
Yeah, it's pretty scary if I mean. Unless robots take over, but I mean, I think it's safer to have humans in control, especially on farms where we really depend on. Is there any way to increase that status, you think? Or that perceived status?
Well, you know, yes, we can completely revolutionize the educational system, but in practical terms, I'm yet to find a solution for it. I keep talking about these issues, just raising awareness, you know, perhaps it'll land on someone more gifted than me, you know, to seek how to address that.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, it's a good point. I talked to a stonemason once in Utrecht, actually. I think it was just before the summer school, who also talked about the same trouble. It's just really hard to find pupils for stonemasonry, and then on top of that, in stonemasonry especially, it's quite hard to earn a living that is high enough, because you need to be fast and good to do your work fast so you can finish products fast, so you can, maybe it's different in other crafts, but that's and maybe in different countries, and it takes a long time before you're well trained in stonemasonry.
That is true. Yes, it's a long period of apprenticeship, and I think that's somehow that seems to be a turnoff for a lot of people. You know, I know the Compagnon system in France extends to Belgium, in Switzerland. Mm-hmm. That typically it's 7 years before you've completed your training program. What's interesting about those things, I think craft in generally, is what happens is you get paid to learn. You know, at least this, it's a little bit different in Europe, but it's the case here in the United States that, you know, many students after 7 years leave, you know, perhaps equipped, often ill-equipped to make a living. And they're burdened down with sometimes, you know, six figures up to $250,000 or more of debt, inescapable debt. And so I always point that out about craft. It's like, not only is it enjoyable, it's meaningful, but during the learning process, you're actually getting paid to learn. You're not paying.
Yeah. Yeah. So those debts you mean for regular people going to university?
Yes. Yeah.
Or yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 That's actually a good one. So you get paid to learn. Is it the same in the United States?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I pay my apprentices when I've had them, living wage, you know. So they're paid more than, I would say, probably neighborhood of 2 to 3 times minimum wage just to learn, you know. And at that point, they're really an expense to the craftsmen. We're hoping to make an investment in them and that they're going to stick with us so that it'll pay off. But, you know, that's the hope.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's been hard on us because they keep washing out. You know, they get to a certain point and the problem I mentioned earlier, facing, you know, low social status. It's not so much the case for those of us who've like really persevered and mastered it. We become fetishized, like, you know, some sort of cultural icon, you know, these master craftsmen. That's another problem.
People want to become TikTok stars, not plasterers or stone carvers.
Yeah. Or even if we do have mastered those skills, it's a bit too much, you know. We're not the type that are looking for accolades and awards. The craft, the art is a reward unto itself.
Yeah, because that's also what the stonemason in Utrecht said, that it's one of the most fulfilling jobs, and in a time where more and more people commit suicide, even because they lead such, in their eyes, meaningless lives that they finish themselves. Craftsmen are often extremely happy. I heard, at least. Is that true?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't, perhaps, but I think many of us don't even think about it in terms of being happy. You know, happiness is one of those things that tends to visit you, you know.
And fulfilled in their jobs, at least.
I would say that is probably a more accurate description. Fulfilled in sometimes in our lives. Yeah. We always have, you know, goals that we're working towards. We're able to pass knowledge along, you know, if teaching is appealing to you, that's another goal you can fulfill. So material goals, societal goals, feel like you're contributing, you know, something at least good to society. And so personally, I found it, I have no regrets, none at all. I love the life of being a craftsman.
Yeah. What do you find so beautiful about plaster as a craft, or the art of plaster?
Well, it allows me to be very materialistic, and materialistic in the sense of, you know, I'm intimate with material. So that's the thing about plaster or stone, or any of these materials, is, you know, it's not something that you control. That's not what being a master means. Actually, the materials, they have their own inherent ways about them. They have their properties, and they're rather stuck in their ways. So what happens is plasterers throughout time, and different cultures and places, they actually have to conform to the material. In the case of plaster, it could be earth, gypsum, lime, some combination thereof, and so it kind of dictates, you know, how she must be treated. And so we end up coming up with very similar approaches, using very similar tools. And that's why I find, as I've traveled all over the world studying plaster, that people from very different cultures than my own, we find as plasterers, stone carvers as well, that we oftentimes have more in common with each other than we do with our next door neighbor. You know, so there's a culture develops around the material. We think we're forming the material, but it informs us.
Yeah. So then it almost sounds like there's some sort of a ground truth in things like materials that shapes us. Well, and that's a completely different view from, well, that everything is relative and subjective. And
Well, as a craftsman,
to be shaped by man,
you know immediately that when you're working with, let's call it plaster of Paris, gypsum molding plaster, you know that the setting time is not relative. It's very fixed. And so you have to conform to it if you want to make anything out of it. You know, there's nothing relative about it. And from my point of view, it's inherent of reality. It's a reflection in a small scale of what the universe is like. It has its ways, and there's nothing relative in that sense about nature, about reality. And it's a window as a craftsman into a very small, you know, small, narrow field of what reality is like, but it's a real one.
Yeah. I think that's a beautiful window into the more philosophical topics, because you have written a lot as well, like on your blog, Real Finishes. You've written a lot of articles about architecture, its place in society, the role of beauty, and other philosophical subjects. So first of all, the modern world. Do you believe we are still capable of creating beauty in this modern world? And if so, how? If not, why?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, and I think the things that craftsmen or artists create, we use the term beauty almost as a metaphor, because the things that we make, in fact, are usually clumsy in a way. I mean, what can you do in stone, after all? I mean, it's a clumsy imitation of something derived from its source in nature that exists. You could take an acanthus leaf. I mean, if you look at an acanthus leaf, there's a myriad of detail, and the closer you look, the more you see in it. What the artist, the craftsman does is understanding the limitations of himself and the limitations of his medium, maybe pulls out of that acanthus leaf the four or five things that are the essence, you could say, of the acanthus leaf. And, you know, he clumsily, to the best of his ability, you know, tries to give it his all, tries to convey that to another human being, what he saw. And then we call that beautiful, when really what it is it's just an act of sympathy. We look at that, we realize someone did that. Someone saw that. And I'm seeing the same thing that person saw in his work. I recognize that he tried to carve an acanthus leaf. And I imagine myself doing it, and I don't know if I could do as good a job as he did, you know? And then there's that admiration. So so that's kind of the things that physically, the material things that we create, and we call them beautiful. What they are is they're the concentration of human attention, and that's what we're resonating with. It, we're talking to each other by means of a medium.
Yeah, as craftsmen, you mean, or
I think craftsmen are speaking to people who aren't craftsmen. You know, in the same way that musicians speak to people that are not musicians through the instrumentation of music.
You don't
have to be a musician to appreciate a fine piece of music, and you just have to be a human being.
But if I see a carved acanthus leaf, I find it incredibly beautiful, and I don't even think of the limitations of the artist or the limitations of the medium. I just see an incredible piece of craft. Because I've never had to learn how to work with stone. So I also recognize it is a lot of effort that went into it. So that, the sympathy. And of course, if you look at a real acanthus leaf, you can literally, through the microscope, still see beauty. But still, just the approximation of nature is beauty enough for me, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think it's the same type of motivation as why we decorate our homes generally, why we set the table for dinner instead of just eat directly out of the bowl. It's because, you know, it's an evidence of care. And so someone cared. And yeah. I think for people, particularly people's homes, public spaces, it applies the same. Public homes essentially are what things like churches and civic buildings are. You know, you really, it's palpable, that feeling that someone really cared about this place. You know, it's like a fine table has been set for you. And it's also, when it lacks that, you really feel it. When it's something inhuman about it, or nobody really cared. It was all about, you know, turn it around, quick, efficient, you know, in and out of here. This is a business after all. No one cared about you personally or society at large. Oof, you really feel that.
Is this where the trouble with machines comes in? Where, for example, you use robots to create sculptures instead of humans?
Yeah, I mean, I think automation... there's a lot of problems with automation. let's take the ecological one first. As I was mentioning, take the medium of stone. Most stone now is worked with robots and machines. We're increasingly having fake stone, you know, faux stone that's you know, manufactured from high embodied energy materials, cements and polymers and other things. Mm-hmm. And when stone is like the most natural, inexhaustible material on the planet. So, so how much, even if, let's say the form is pleasing to you, knowing, just looking at it, knowing the ecological costs that's taking place, you know, how can you really enjoy it? There's a nagging feeling in the back of your mind, knowing the poisoning that's occurring, the price that's really being paid to produce that thing.
Yeah, but when I look at a fake stone thing, not like a real thing, but like a polymer stone. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But even with real stone, I mean, that's been machined. Those machines aren't, you know, they come at a high cost, you know. Also, if you've ever been in like a industrial stone quarry, places where they shape that stone, the dust is pulverized. Everyone has to be wearing protection for their ears, protection for their lungs, protection from the vibration. You know, they've taken something that's quite noble and almost zen-like, the working of stone. Having apprenticed 3 years myself and having completed some stone carving projects, there's nothing more beautiful in the world than to carve stone, to be at one with the material. And so a lot of times we're focused on the use of a thing, the form of a thing, and we're not thinking about the other beneficial side of architecture. Architecture is something that there's no more activity that human beings do that more resources and more time is spent on.
Yeah.
And if we're not taking into account, did the craftsman have pleasure in his work? You know, was he a contributor to his design or even how the thing comes into existence? I mean, that's just been summarily, the human side of just summarily, you know, set aside. Yeah. And so, on the altar of some supposed efficiency, yet the things that we make with automation don't last, and they come at such, as mentioned, such high cost. So, are these things really economical?
Some people probably think or believe the solution to the bad effects of automation is better and more automation, smarter robots, better algorithms, more fancy chisels. I don't know. But is that the solution, or do we have to return to human power some way?
We've been at the game of automation now. It's not something new. We've been at the game now for two centuries. And that's always kind of the carrot that's dangled in front of it, that, you know, we must stay the course. Mm-hmm. Actually, we've gone too far to ever consider turning back. You know, it's this kind of cult of progress. We must progress. And
yeah, for its own sake.
There's been so many blunders. Technology has led to extraordinary environmental problems, social problems. But the attitude remains that there are no solutions for the blunders of technology, but further investments in technology. I think that it's foolhardy not to disallow even looking at the treasure trove of what is all of our inheritance, like everything that came before, no matter where it was on the planet and what time period it was. I mean, that's my inheritance. That belongs to me. Yeah. I'm a human being, and anything that human beings have attempted or done, I feel I have a right to. And so I guess I'm an appropriator at heart. I appropriate it all. And so if there's anything that could help my society, the subsequent generation that's in that treasure trove of human knowledge, because it is knowledge.
Yeah.
Even the word technology literally means logia, means knowledge, comes from the Greek, as does techne, which means craft. So technology means essentially the knowledge of handcraft, everything that came before. Now, that word has been appropriated only to mean industrial technology, digital robotic technology, but it started off as a very human term.
Mm-hmm. And now we are closing ourselves off from all those solutions of the past on purpose, even in architecture, with letting go of all the traditions. Although, does it have to be that way for the crafts? Is there, I mean, it's probably very hard to figure this one out.
Well, it all depends on who's holding what I call the tape measure. You know, how you set up the equation to begin with dictates the results. So if your return on investment on a piece of architecture is 5 to 10 years, then of course the industrial solutions make the most sense. You know, it's you reduce labor cost or eliminate them altogether, and you're able to turn a quick profit. But if you're building for multi-generationally and to in a truly sustainable way, then you think completely different. So that's why I'm saying the built environment, modernist architecture came, decades, even centuries after the modernist philosophy. When a certain way of thinking became dominant, it's just the material manifestation. It's the logical fulfillment of that way of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then maybe a slight AI. It's another form of technology. I've been playing around with it to create those images with tools like Midjourney to create building cityscapes. And a lot of people find it is an alarming development. Do you think it's a threat to human creativity, like outsourcing one more thing we used to rely on with our own brains? Or do you think it will kind of have its own place next to human creativity? Or what is your view on AI?
Well, I think it's not new. So I remember in my engineering school, when I went to university for engineering, I took the last class that was being offered to learn how to draft by hand. By that time, AutoCAD, this was like 1990, AutoCAD was already firmly established, and people thought I was crazy to take it. I think there was like two of us in the entire engineering program, who took this last class. Fortunate for me, I was able to learn this alongside aerospace engineers, some folks who worked on some of the space programs for NASA, where everything was drawn one-to-one scale, and you always checked your work and had colleagues check your work, showed your work and had colleagues check your work, because if someone made a mistake, people died. And it was very precise, very disciplined, very rigid. And it was a great gift to me, because just with that and the book of Euclid, I can do almost anything. Yeah. And but when you have computer programs, like AutoCAD. They're really a form of artificial intelligence. Now we have BIM software, things like Revit, where it does all the thinking for you, directly tied to industrial manufacturers, and you know, all the estimators are built in, what labor should cost, what materials should cost. Certain things that are being promoted can be designed very quickly, but anything that involves human creativity, the software doesn't really permit it. And let's say you go through the heroic task of learning all these things on your own, so that you could try and work outside of it. Well, in the context of an industrially produced society, to work outside of that becomes, by the measures we talked about previously, completely inefficient. So it would be essentially practically economic suicide for an architectural designer to work outside of those constraints.
Yeah. But still, we see it happening now with more premium developments. Country houses by Adam Architecture, for example, they still hand draw some of their country homes. I mean, of course, then they turn it into CAD. But
well, as a communication tool, like a distribute, drawings or something. I mean, I don't use it myself, but I understand. But I've always looked at that type of software as just being a communication tool. It's not a design tool. When you become reliant on it, you're hampered. And with every iteration, with every successive generation of the software, and I've seen this in my lifetime, the designer is more and more hampered and restricted into what the programming wants him to do. So it's really good at just at making boxes out of glass, concrete, and steel with spray foam insulation. That's what it excels. I mean, I could never design boxes the way that BIM software can.
So maybe we should just get rid of the software.
It would be amazing if architectural education, is like craft education, was rooted in something real. And it's the simplest of tools, simply a compass, a rule, and some sort of scribe. And that has created the most, what is agreed by everyone, including the modernists, is some of the most amazing, beautiful structures that mankind has ever been able to produce. It created the Taj Mahal. It created the Cathedrale de Notre Dame. It created, the Kuala Lumpur. Did I get that right? But all the magnificent architecture around the planet has been created with the simplest of instruments. We don't need more technology. We need something beautiful in our lives, something handmade, something we can resonate with, because we're not interested in the inner workings of machines. We're interested in other human beings. That's what's fundamental to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I fully agree. Architecture education should at least have some tough courses with measured drawing and hand drawing, because at our summer school, we also had a wonderful course by Robert Cox and Connor Lynch in hand drawing, measured drawing. And I think it teaches a lot. I think it might even be too short of a part of the summer school curriculum.
And that's what's happening with all of these summer schools. The moment they're freed from the constraints of having to basically interpret all human thought through machines, immediately they banish them and go right back to hand drawings. Every summer school around the planet is doing this. It's what people actually resonate with. It's what they want to do.
You get an outburst of form and of creativity as well.
Absolutely. They're creating, I mean, these are real novices typically that are coming. People are still sometimes in high school. If they're professional, it's early on in their practice. And in just a matter of a couple of weeks, they're creating things that they're actually proud of and that they've excels anything that they've ever done, even in their professional practice. So it's quite liberating.
Mm-hmm. Is this what makes things authentic, or what does it mean to be or to make something authentic nowadays?
Well, there's a difference between authentication and automation. So, you know, I think authentic, even the word itself, means self-making. And so all traditional societies were authentic. I mean, they took care of their food, their clothes, their shelter, their medicine. Mm-hmm. They had knowledge. And whereas automatic, where automation comes from, is makes itself. It's something that exists independent of humanity. That's the point of it. But it relates to humans only as consumers. So you no longer have the ability to feed yourself, to clothe yourself, to medicate yourself.
Yeah.
These are now developed in codified in systems. And as a result, you become passive and dependent on some sort of corporate or state bureaucracy that you have no influence on whatsoever. And it's a means of control. It's a means of control of people. Craft is very threatening to big systems, because what it means is autonomy, you know. And that's why, again, that's why I think you mentioned earlier, you find that craftsmen are generally very happy. Well, they're a little bit freer than your average human being, at least in this one aspect of their lives. You know,
it's liberating, like growing your own food. Mm-hmm. So do you think, well, maybe this is a bit of a detour, but is there, like, I often hear like this or that is threatening to big systems, but do you think it's automatically, there is some kind of a force or pressure created by those systems on purpose to reduce the amount of crafts being used, or to reduce people growing their own food, like...
Oh, absolutely.
Concerted efforts.
Absolutely. Yeah? You know, I'll speak more to craft since that's what I'm most familiar with. But as Western society first, and now society globally, I mean, Africa and India and everywhere else is becoming the same way, we have building codes. And those building codes, basically in a very subtle way, through the promotion of industrial materials, writing those codes ostensibly neutral, but writing them in such a way that only some highly energy embodied, industrially produced material could meet the specification, have essentially bureaucratically made everything traditional illegal. Like, you know, we couldn't build a Gothic cathedral today. You know, according to the codes, it won't work. It doesn't matter that they've been up for, you know, close to a millennium. Yeah. You know, it's illegal. Same with all the earthen construction. You know, we've been building with dirt for thousands of years. Well, you can't build that way anymore. You know, you have to build according to this specification. As it turns out, the only thing that meets that specification is glass, steel, concrete, and spray foam insulation. So, it's very deliberate. It's a means of exercising control. So the craftsmen are just one of those few beacons, in a sense, of liberty for human dignity that remain.
Yeah. And, but then who are the evil masterminds using building codes to suppress craft? Is there a plan there, or is it just kind of some unintended side consequence of building codes? Well, or is there really some malintent there?
It's not unintentional. It's quite intentional, but, you know,
For people to protect people from themselves, kind of.
Yes, absolutely. I think for the most part, these kind of bureaucratic, for lack of a better term, technocratic structures that we've created think that their goals are noble, because individuals, people can't be trusted. And so we're going to determine what's best for you. And it's built also on a false premise, I believe, that man is somehow a domesticable animal, that with enough social conditioning, That human beings can be pacified, and they can be made happy because their, you know, basic needs, as are determined by some system, are met. So civilization is progressing towards this kind of goal of human happiness and contentment. And so, you know, it's all very noble, but it's also, human beings aren't anything like that. So that's keeps running up against this thorny problem. So we were introducing things like maybe we can medicate, or maybe we can genetically modify everything it takes to get the human being, you know, the naked monkey to behave more like a sheep.
Yeah. And there is, or there tends to be, one leading narrative of how humans should behave and how humans should live.
And that's today's narrative. You've lived long enough to know that narrative changes on a dime. You know, it's whatever lubricates the gears of the system, what's ever best for it. So human beings just become, before this kind of artificial god, they just become, cogs in this great industrial machine that has its own momentum. So to find that cabal, to find this conspiracy, to find the thought that we can find the bad people and root them out, we've created something that's become a master over us, and we've created this kind of it's been talked about for many years. I think English philosopher Thomas Hobbes described it as Leviathan. And he felt it was already in place. This is the 17th century in his day, and that we're nothing before it. And his advice at that time was basically conform, because it's already too big to stop. That's 17th century, 1600s.
Wow, kind of the best mistake. But that's a time where they still built beauty, so it's gone downhill from there.
But the enclosure movement was happening in England. The beginnings of the first little beginnings of industrialization were occurring. And he was a visionary. He was a very smart man, and he saw what was coming, and that in a sense, it always happens with the very elite of society. It was already in place. So went through a long period where the city, after a subsequent, in ancient history, we had great civilizations focused on the city, like the Babylonians, the Assyrians, Egyptians, and Romans. But it fall into a period where human beings during the medieval period were not, the city was not the focus. And what he saw was that kind of civilizing process reestablishing itself, you know. And shortly after he wrote that, London was to become the greatest city in the world, you know. And so that infrastructure had been established.
Yeah. Thinking about our times and where we stand in the world, they say we live in a postmodern world. What does this have any meaning? What time do you think we really live in? And is there a need to identify the time we live in?
This is coming at it from a little bit of a philosophical point. Yes, I think we're transitioning into a postmodern society. It's not been very much reflected too much in the built environment yet, because it always seems to lag behind. But they're essentially something I'm writing about. Essentially, three phases, you could say, of the "quote unquote" modern world. I think we really see it beginning in the Renaissance, where we have humanism. And although, you know, I think so many people look back to the Renaissance as an incredibly beautiful time in architecture, and it's just this flowering of beauty. There's a mentality shift that occurs in the Renaissance, where beauty was not something to be a process, an ontological reality behind the phenomenal world that we see, but it was something that human beings could control. We could, and they make these statements that we have now exceeded the natural world in creating beauty. There's this type of arrogance that's taking place in the Renaissance period, and it was kind of like the first of the transcendentals, what was considered medieval times transcendentals, to fall. And it was followed up by the Enlightenment, which was truth. And we think particularly of Galileo and Newton. They thought they had a corner on reality, that they could actually understand reality. They had mathematical and physical principles that they could apply, and that the universe could be understood as if it was like some machine. And so, like, we had immanent beauty instead of transcendental beauty. Truth was no longer something to be revealed. It was something to be articulated and dictated, in a sense, by man.
Yeah. Constructed, kind of.
And that's really that's what's ushered in the modern world. That's the dominating narrative of the epoch we live in. The last of those transcendentals is the moral plane. It's what it means to be good, what it means to be just. And as I think there's been disappointment with what human beings could create in the way of beauty, there has also been disappointment with what the mechanical worldview this has ushered in, the world that it's created, because we live in a modernist world now. This postmodern movement is all the arguments are shifting to the moral plane. What's good and right, but it's not like discovering what's good and discovering what's right. It's again, it's imminent. It's we, through our own creative resources, are going to be the arbiters of what is good, of what is just.
So imposing what is good.
And that will have a physical manifestation in architecture. It's coming, and I don't think we'll have to wait long. Maybe it's already starting to occur, and it's only in retrospect that we'll recognize it. But morality is the next postmodern manifestation in architecture.
Does this, I don't want to make it political, but does this tie into the culture wars going on right now, this shift of thought, thinking about morality?
Yeah, no, I think that's very much the case. I don't think of it as so much in political terms, partisan political terms. They just seem to be an echo chamber for what's already happening in society, particularly with the elite are thinking, because all the values that are society's values are those with the resources to broadcast them. And it's always going to be the highly educated, the elite of society that, you know, is determining, you know, what is good, what is right. And
Yeah, because on your blog, you do write a lot about beauty, truth, and the good. And you also offer some critique on modernism. So does modernism violate these three truths, beauty, and the good? And if so, how?
Well, I think modernism, in the sense of what we call modernist architecture, it basically discarded the humanist project. It had no use for beauty, and it was more concerned with truth, you know. And so, whereas beauty is really, we access as human beings, we access what we call beauty. Beauty is just a word, but we access that feeling that we have, that kind of intuition that there's something underlying existence, feeling you get before either a flower or a waterfall, you know, that type of feeling. And that sometimes we have something similar to it behind a great work of art or architecture. I think modernism's focus really was desensualizing. So all those feelings we get are coming in through the senses. So it's a part of us that is comes in through our smell, our sight, our hearing. It's pure instinct. And modernism's focus was on truth. And truth was, rather than being perceptual and sensual, is cognitive and intellectual. And so that's what you find about the modernist movement, to be able to clearly put into focus that type of intellectual understanding. They felt it was an impediment to have any form of sensuality. That's what you see, particularly with early modernism, is it's completely desaturated of color. Typically, it's only white, sometimes grays and blacks for a touch of contrast. The shapes become regular geometric shapes. So it's this is kind of a fetish for the four boxes.
Yeah.
All of the punched openings are similar rectangles or such. You know, occasionally, they'll do the occasional sphere. So all of these things can be understood cognitively. All the software that is used now, BIM software, AutoCAD, I hate to use a brand name, but all these things, basically, everything is designed in space.
Right? Yeah.
So when you go into the screen, you're in a field of blackness, and all there are these three abstract dimensions. And so you're being asked to design in a type of heaven. It's completely dematerialized, nothing to do with heaven at all. I mean, Earth at all. And so there's no gravity in the program. There's no sun, moon, or stars. There's no rivers. You're working in heaven. So it's in a way, it's very spiritual because it's just conceptual.
Wow. Yeah. And what you can create with concrete, it's, well, the favorite building material, you can orientate it in any way you like, because it gives so much freedom of what you can build that you can support that conceptual way of thinking with actual construction methods.
Yeah, but it's a type of freedom that's alien, because human beings, Earth happens to be our home. We like rivers and oceans and sand and mountains and all of these things. We like gravity and we like flowers in springtime. So although it's intellectually, cognitively, for those who are so inclined, can resonate, I guess there's a certain pleasure that you can derive as you would from an algebraic equation, if you're mathematically inclined. Yeah. For the average human being, they're sensual. And what they respond to is the living world around them, not to abstract concepts in space.
And that is also a part of truth, and yet it's ignored in this other type of definition of truth.
Well, yeah, I mean, the Earth is in itself truth. It is what it is,
Yeah. If you keep architecture as a very intellectual exercise, this conceptual, theoretical modernist view of architecture, they ignore emotion, mental effects, biology as a part of truths. And why aren't those included, I wonder?
And it's similar to mathematics, I mean, being a civil engineer major, I went very far in mathematical studies. I was good at it. But I also found that, it's just cryptography. It's just puzzle solving. It's all... at the end of the day, it's one thing is one side of the equal sign, one thing is on the other. It's all tautologies. It's an interesting activity for human beings, as I'm sure modernism is for those who practice it, but I just don't feel they should be in charge of anything. I'm not saying they should be forbidden, it shouldn't exist. I'm not against them in that sense, but, the rest of us just want to live in a place that's resonates with us, and so they shouldn't be in charge of communities.
So how do we defeat modernism, or what is left of it?
Well, I think in a certain sense the postmodernists are already coming for them, but the question is, how does all of that how is balance restored to humanity? And I think, as I had mentioned earlier, things have to run their course. All this is going to collapse. And it's not because, craftsmen like myself, are willing it to collapse. It's because ultimately nature is dynamic and it's not static. And as a craftsman, I learned a long time ago, you can't impose your will on it for long. It'll break you. You're not going to break it. And so, like all static systems that are not adaptable, they're going to fail. They're going to collapse under their own weight. And we all have this instinct. I don't. You don't have to be a traditionally minded person to have that instinct. People are worried for their children, for their grandchildren. They have different coping mechanisms to deal with it. Sometimes it's just focusing on the here and now. Sometimes it's imagining, you know, that some new scheme is going to be what's going to solve everything. But deep down, they know that these systems are in deep, deep trouble, and they're heading towards a collapse. You know, I mean, maybe it'll go on for another century, but it's we know in the grand scheme of things, it's not going to last very long.
Yeah. And then you're talking about modernism as a way of building, designing, constructing, or in general, more societal?
I think our entire society is destined for collapse because the industrial society that we live under, a technological society that we live under, is everything is interconnected about it. So you can't have the political systems that you have, the social infrastructure that you have. You can't have any of it now. It's all completely subservient to the needs of the industrial systems.
Yeah,
you know, we've kind of painted ourselves into a bit of a corner. So it's
you. Yeah,
I'll give you a good example.
System. Yeah, yeah.
We now it's very typical of European cities that actually I think Europe is the most urbanized continent. You have over 80% of people now live in what are considered urban centers in Europe, you know, and going back maybe 150 years ago, it was something like 5 to 7%. I mean, basically Europe was a collection of villages, very agricultural, very craft based, and, in a very short period of time has completely urbanized. And, what surrounds all of the old city centers, which anymore, very few locals live there anymore. It's all kind of been occupied by the mega wealthy or out for tourists or whatever. People are living in these giant rings of, you know, the banlieue or the equivalent in all the European cities now. People that come from families that used to craft, that used to be farmers, they're completely estranged from that. They can't feed themselves anymore. They can't make anything for themselves anymore. And so there's been this kind of great loss of knowledge, incredible loss of knowledge that's occurred. And the countryside is really just emptied out, you know. And I think we're under the mistaken belief that an empty countryside is, you know, is safer because human beings are dangerous. We're just like locusts. You know, that's the illustration I always hear. We're like locusts, and you know, you can keep them contained in the city. It's somehow going to protect nature. But what happens is, you know, the people that were there generationally on some piece of land, they knew their land, and they were stewards of it. They had nowhere else to go, and that's how culture was formed. And so, if they mistreated the land would punish them directly. So, so they learned to be very, very good stewards of that place. And so now those places are, there's no one to protect them anymore. And and so they're really at risk of to the needs of the system, you know. They could be exploited. And then once you're in a city and, you know, you're cut off from reality in a sense, you're in an artificial environment. You only think about your own boredom, your own needs. And so it's, human beings aren't naturally like that, but yeah, they can be made to be like that. They can be made to think only in consumption and be so estranged from where their food and other things are coming from. They don't think, they won't even want to think about how it's made. Just, they just want more.
We don't even want to know.
Yeah. We don't want to know. It's painful because you can't do anything about it anyway. Yeah. Right. That's the feeling that I get from it. Of course it's technically it's not true, but we've created this kind of condition where human beings are very, you know, subject to these greater societal forces. They've lost all that autonomy that they had.
Yeah.
Just simply a few generations ago, not long ago.
Mm-hmm. Should mankind even live in a city, or should we return to the countryside?
Well, I think it's hard to say. You know, I think cities, their recent development. I don't know, how long human beings have existed as what we would consider human beings. Minimum a couple hundred thousand years. But cities are brand new. 6,000-7,000 years ago were the first things that we could really call a city. But they appeared to be, they didn't grow out of villages. They just appeared whole cloth. All of a sudden you had this rational system. Grid streets appeared immediately. All the infrastructure of a city just all at once. Boom, it was there. It was there in Ur. It was there in Babylon and all these ancient places.
Mm-hmm.
And it always seems to be connected to coercion. All of these early societies had slaves. They would conquer neighboring tribes, villages, whatever. They would conscript, and ostensibly to create progress, to create a better way of life for a select few. And so... It always claims to have noble pursuits, but my view is that human beings have many, many different ways of legitimate existence. There's connected villages, there's monastic or ascetic type of a life. There's tribes, of course, always get a bad rap, but tribes tend to be very connected to the earth, and it's a very sustainable way of life as well. The thing I like about tribes in particular is that their villages are the same. They're very tolerant of other ways of life. You know, they're more inward looking. They don't really care what you're doing. The city is different that way. It's like, it's very intolerant. The thought that tribes exist or villages that are not under their jurisdiction is offensive to them, you know, and there is a moral, I think, undercurrent. They feel that their way of life is the best. And they're going to help you.
Cosmopolitan.
Whether you like it view. Or not.
Yeah.
And
is that a cosmopolitan view? Or?
I think it's a civilizing view. You know, I think the complaint that cities have against other ways of life is they're not civilized.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we say that all the time. It's uncivilized, as if it were a bad thing. And but the city is the one going around consuming all the resources it's true. I admit it. You don't get an opera in a village, but you don't get a nuclear bomb there either. You know?
Yeah.
That's only possible with civilizations. And it's totalitarian in its very nature. Oppression is built right into it. And, you know, in Paris, when you're getting your croissant, you don't think about everything that it takes to get that croissant. You know? Again, something is very hard to have without a city. But,
But then what's the solution? Do we abolish society, or do we just learn to live with the consequences?
Yeah, I think you... Sometimes, you know, it's like a, it's like some children have to learn the hard way. And unfortunately, I think that's the case for humanity.
Yeah.
We have to almost, I think, even if we understand it intellectually by having a conversation like this, I think we have to learn it at the genetic level. We have to understand that this type of mass society, you know, this kind of anonymous society where we have to hand all authority over to systems because we're dealing with trying to organize millions or billions of people and we're dealing with an infinite amount of unknowables is not good for us. And we have to have a... at the genetic level, this strong repulsion for it. And I think that might take subsequent generations and a lot of suffering to get there.
Learning on a genetic level. We need individual suffering for the betterment of the system.
We don't understand how, in a certain sense, because we're of our incredible wealth, able to extract all the resources of the planet in very short order, we're not feeling the true pain of what we're doing right now because we're just so rich. We're following the opposite of the Taoist principle, that is to do less. That's what we really need to be doing. We need to be doing less. We don't need to do more.
I think that's a wonderful last message as well, perhaps for this episode, because we've been talking for over an hour. Do you have any other last things for the audience to share or how people can follow you?
I'm not difficult to find. I'd say you can just type in my name into Google, Patrick Webb, and then you can put plaster, arts and crafts, philosophy, those type of things, and then you'll be inundated with... you know, sometimes I go there myself and I read things and it's like, wow, that's really interesting. You know, I've been writing for many years now. And it's like, wow, I never thought of that.
Yeah.
Oh, wait a minute. I did think of that some time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, I've read some of your articles. They're outstanding. I will link your blog at least in the link and perhaps some videos because there's plenty there. So, thank you so much for this wonderful talk. We really fluently went from kind of question to question, but not in like the order I had written them in, but they kind of followed up naturally, but in a very random order. So that was really fun to see. So,
okay.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. Thank you for having me, Ruben.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Aesthetic City podcast. For more information about Patrick and to read his articles, visit his website, Real Finishes. I included the link below. If you like our content and want to support what we do, you can support us in various ways. The easiest way is to give this podcast a favorable review. Another way to support this podcast is to share it with colleagues and friends. You can also follow us on X, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or our Substack newsletter. And finally, the ultimate way to support The Aesthetic City is to become a patron. Find the Patreon link in the description. For more information about this platform, visit theaestheticcity.com. Thank you, until next time.